Artificial intelligence, if we're being frank, is a con, a bill of goods you are being sold to line someone's pockets. Those are the feisty words of my guest today, Emily Bender, who a few years ago began a podcast called Mystery AI Hype Theatre 3000. Its message was, don't believe the ridiculous claims of tech boosters and the journalists who fawn over them. One of her primary weapons in her fight is, of course, humour. Dr. Emily Bender is a professor of linguistics at the University of Washington, and her new book is called The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want, co-authored with Alex Hanna. Emily, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Emily, let's look first at the doomers, because you make the argument that the people who say that AI is taking us, you know, the human race to its final destination, and those who say, you know, it's going to create paradise for us all, are two sides of the same coin. Is that right?
Yeah. So they are often presented and present themselves as opposite ends of a spectrum. But in fact, there's very little daylight between. The boosters say AI is a thing, it's inevitable, it's coming really soon, and it's going to solve all of our problems. And the doomers say AI is a thing, it's inevitable, it's coming really soon, and it's going to kill us all. And you can see that it's just that weird turn at the end for both of them that differentiates them. But the mistake and the misapprehension is at the very start of that.
You point out that notions of the human race, or even just the creator being destroyed by what is created, goes way, way back in the human imagination. It's a pretty primary nightmare, isn't it?
Yes, and a really common trope in our imaginative fiction stories, right? You have, you know, Frankenstein, for example, is an early example, but so also is the figure of the golem in Jewish folklore.
How does the golem operate?
The golem is a clay figure, I believe, who is activated with a certain word. And if you, it does what you've activated it to do, and then problems arise when you forget to deactivate it.
You're not saying there aren't actually considerable dangers in AI, but they're not the dangers the doomers point to. Is that right?
That's right. There's actually not just dangers, but actual harms that we're seeing now across a wide spectrum. So there's environmental degradation, there is labor exploitation behind the systems, there is a displacement of work. It's not that people's that the work is being taken off of people's hands. It's usually being displaced to other people in a much more casualized, gigified economy. There is the ability to automate discriminatory systems and sort of replicate harm faster than we can provide recourse. And there is the pollution of our information ecosystem. And all of these things are happening now. They aren't hypothetical risks, and they're real.
And how do we combat them?
It's tricky. There are things that we can do. I think it depends a little bit for each of the harms. We want to focus in on them. So we want to stand up for workers' rights on the one hand. We want to be very careful about environmental impacts. So whenever a data center is coming in, we need to insist that the people setting it up are completely like on the record with what exactly they're doing with water and electricity. And we want to insist that companies are transparent about what data they've used and where they got it. And we really want to insist on watermarking or some other way of tracking the synthetic media that is just spilling out into our information ecosystem right now without means of cleaning it up.
We may want to do all those things, but the companies who are selling AI are immensely powerful. I mean, only the other day, didn't Canada have to retreat on the fairly obvious notion of taxing these businesses in the face of threats from the United States government?
Yes. So there's power both in terms of the wealth that's been concentrated and then the sort of political deployment of that wealth. But I really think it is worth standing up individually and collectively and not giving up before we've actually entered the fight. And it's disappointing when regulators back down. Similarly, when OpenAI released ChatGPT originally, the Italian GDPR regulator actually banned it for a while on the grounds that they were not handling Italians' data appropriately. And unfortunately, they didn't stick to their guns on that. OpenAI basically said, okay, you can opt out of having us hold on to what you put into the system. But the fact that ChatGPT can output Italian language text means that there's enormous amounts of Italian people's data in there that the regulator could have kept pushing about.
I take for granted that all of your work is in there.
It is a good assumption these days that anything that is, as my co-author Alex Handel likes to say, not nailed down on the internet has been scooped up by these companies.
I know that all my work has been scraped. And if you are of the mind, you can get ChatGPT to write text in my style. And I'm sure that the style of Emily Bender can be reproduced by ChatGPT.
You know, one thing that's happened a few times, I don't know that it's ChatGPT, but I think Gemini and some of the others, I have found quotes attributed to me in journalistic articles online that are nothing I've ever said. And then I've written to the journalist saying, please take that down, I didn't say that, and gotten back an admission that they had actually just asked Gemini for an article and it came out.
Yep. Is the rule that any text created by AI, and in a minute we're going to discuss whether AI as an expression has any meaning, whatever, but is it true that any text created by AI has to be checked by a human being?
I guess it depends on what you're using it for. If your goal is to just like, you know, if you wanted a replacement for lorem ipsum to fill up some text on a page, then you wouldn't have to check what it says, I suppose. But if you are interested in using synthetic text in some communicative way where you're going to be accountable for what it says, then yeah, you'd want to check it.
Like lawyers in court.
For example, and I am shocked that so many of them keep getting in trouble for this because I would have thought that lawyers gossiped more. And the first time someone got smacked down for submitting a legal brief or filing that had fake cases cited because they just trusted ChatGPT or whatever, that people would wise up to that. But somehow there's, I think, enough marketing behind it that people keep falling for it.
Think of the time you save. Think of the billable hours that can go into your pocket by doing that.
Well, but really? Because if you're saving all the time, then you've got less. If you're really billing by the hour and you're doing it faster, I don't think you're getting benefits there.
Now, you raise the fundamental point that AI in itself is a strange and really empty expression. What is AI? I know that you continue to use it, and I'm using it as well, having read what you wrote, but I think you argue that AI doesn't actually exist.
Yeah. Well, I tried my hardest not to use the phrase without taking distance from it. So I think it's okay to talk about the AI industry or the AI research field because that refers to the people who think they're working on this. But there is not a coherent set of technologies named by that label. You could say, what does artificial intelligence, the phrase, mean? It means venture capitalists, please give me some cash. Right. It's just marketing, and we are much better served by naming the technologies specifically. So, you know, are you doing synthetic text extrusion? Are you doing automatic transcription? Are you doing image classification? So talk in particular rather than lumping all that together as one thing because it's not one thing. Or if you need a more general label, we can talk about automation. And I think that that also keeps the conversation clearer.
But isn't the idea behind the term AI the notion that it is possible to make a computer actually think?
That's the goal, and that's why it's got that name to it. Drew McDermott referred to this as a wishful mnemonic, that it's basically computer programmers naming their systems after what they wish they were doing rather than what they actually do.
Where does it come from? Who first used it?
When
did it crop up?
It dates to the 1950s. So there was a summer school or summer research project at Dartmouth that was funded, I think, by U.S. military money involving John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky and a few others. And they needed a label for what they wanted to work on that sounded sort of appealing enough to attract the funds and would also differentiate them from the work of Norbert Wiener, who they didn't like, who was working on something called cybernetics. And so they came up with this term artificial intelligence and proposed that they could make, you know, good progress on this problem over the course of 8 weeks in the summer of 1956.
But what is the proof that you really draw on to say machines can't be intelligent?
So it comes in two parts. The first is that the very notion of intelligence doesn't have a good definition. So anyone who's claiming they've built an intelligent system is already like on very thin ice. It's like, how did you evaluate that? What was the experiment that you did to show that your system has this property that can't be defined? So that's one problem. Another issue, and this is where the linguistics really comes into it, is that the main reason people believe they are interacting with a system that they would call intelligent is that we are interacting through language. And I can tell you in two parts why it is that I know that ChatGPT isn't all that. On the one hand, languages are systems of science. That is, there's always the form, the sounds that we make, the symbols that we write, and what they mean. And these systems are trained only on the form side of it. They don't have access to meaning or communicative intent. And so they can't possibly have learned it, learning in scare quotes there too, because it's not in the input data. The second thing that's really important is to think about how we understand when we understand language. It's easy to imagine that the person who's speaking took an idea, packed it into words, sent the words across, and then you just unpacked it from the words, that the meaning is in the words. In fact, what we learn from psycholinguistics is it doesn't work that way at all, that when we understand, we are picturing everything we know about the person who's speaking, what we believe to have in common ground between us and them, and what we believe that they know about us or whoever their intended audience was. And against all of that background, we ask ourselves, what must they have been trying to convey by choosing those words in that order? And what's key there is that in understanding language, we are always imagining a mind behind the text. And that's fine when it's another person that we're dealing with. But we need to learn how to take distance from it when we are doing all of that imagination looking at text that came out of ChatGPT or another one of these large language models.
Is another problem that intelligence depends to some extent on desire, and desire doesn't, and so far as we know, has not been artificially replicated.
So I think it is something about, are we talking about intelligence? Are we talking about cognition? Are we talking about consciousness? But the sort of experience of being alive is very much about navigating the world and just trying to survive as a kind of desire, I think, but also desire for connection and so on.
Yes.
And, you know, you can certainly create a computer program where the system, the algorithm basically is designed to maximize a certain kind of point, for example. And there's people who work on like automated video game playing systems, which is one of those things where you're like, well, what do we need that for? Right? What's the purpose of that?
Isn't it supposed to be played?
Yeah. But there's a story, and I'm sorry I don't have the reference to exactly who did this, but it was some system for playing one of these games where you're, I think, racing in a world and collecting certain kinds of prizes. And the system was set up to maximize a score, but there was a certain property of the game where if you basically just ran the vehicle in circles, you could get a really high score, but get no closer to the end of the game. And so the system just kind of fell into that like dead end and just went around and around and around.
I don't know, Emily. That sounds like life in some of its aspects. You mentioned sources. And one of the weapons you talk about to expose the fallacies of AI is check the sources.
Yes. Yes. So one of our catchphrases in our podcast is always read the footnotes, because all of this work that looks like it's being published in scientific papers and you get this really excited journalism covering it, you dig through and the thing hasn't been peer-reviewed. It's mostly citing other things that haven't been peer-reviewed or company blog posts or things like that. And it's like, yeah, this is actually all one big fantasy world, but it's taking on the sort of shape of scientific discourse. And you have to look into it and see what's going on to figure out is this real science or is this people who are collectively spinning a fantasy?
Those fantasies are going to become chains, aren't they? Because a false reference, you know, a made-up reference in one academic paper is going to be quoted in the next academic paper. But then perhaps a wonderful algorithm can be invented which will search the reality of sources all the way back to the start. Perhaps we could look forward to that.
Perhaps we can. I mean, there are some systems like from the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence in Seattle called Semantic Scholar. Google also has a product called Google Scholar that do citation tracking. So you can see which papers cite which other papers. But if you have a fake citation and lots of people cite it, it's just going to show up in those indices as something that people cite.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Barr. I'm talking to Emily Bender, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Washington, about her book, The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. Emily, you make the point that artificial intelligence replicates prejudice, replicates kind of some of the worst notions of the human race, sets them in mathematics.
Yes, and this becomes particularly pernicious because we are also trained to see computers as objective because they are not subjected to, you know, human emotions, desires, beliefs, biases, right? So they're set up as objective and also painted as all-knowing. We've trained this on everything we could download from the internet. And so that gives us this idea that there is this like view from nowhere and it's got lots of viewpoints in it. And so therefore it is going to be objective. When in fact, if you actually drill into these data sets, you can see that they are not even the best we could possibly do given the internet as a starting point. And then you end up with these statistical systems that are designed to find and replicate the patterns in the input data. And those patterns are going to replicate, you know, our historical systems of oppression. There's a researcher, Dr. Abeba Berhane, who points out that any kind of machine learning is inherently conservative in the sense that it sets up the patterns of the past as a good way to build the future.
And those patterns can be dreadful.
Indeed.
What happens when the huge amounts of money that you talk about that are pouring into AI, you know, get up at a conference and say, you know, I've got an AI breakthrough here, and to believe your book, billions flow. What happens when that money doesn't earn money?
You know, it's interesting, and this is really a question more for an economist or maybe my co-author who's a sociologist than for a linguist. But it is surprising to me that the bubble has gone on as far as it has, because these systems are really not making that much money. I mean, you've got NVIDIA that makes the chips that everyone needs to run these systems. They're making money. But OpenAI is just burning cash. And they are still somehow, you know, the player to beat that everyone wants to be like, even though they don't have a business model. And we have been through this once before, right? At least once before. So the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s, crashed pretty hard. My concern is that the crash, and this is a part of the book called The Grimy Residue of the AI Bubble, that is due initially to Alex. She talks there about how we have, you know, not just the loss of, like, you know, retirement funds and things like that, but also all of these systems that have been sort of deformed to work around the idea that the synthetic text extruding machine is actually going to solve all of our problems. And then you take that thing out, which wasn't really working, but we had sort of oriented towards it anyway, and we're going to have a lot of recovery to do in terms of rehiring people, in terms of recreating career pathways that have been damaged in the process of everyone orienting towards this imagined artificial intelligence.
But even if the system sort of turns out to be financially tacky, even if the system is not as dangerous as our worst fears, there is still this notion that's been instilled in us now for 20 or 30 years of anthropomorphizing the work of machines. What's that doing to us?
Yeah. I think just at the level of the hype, anthropomorphizing language is a real problem. And it is, I think, both valuable and entertaining to catch the words that we use and find ways to rephrase. So when we say, I asked ChatGPT something, just using that word ask is setting up the system as something that can be in a conversation. And even the chat and chatbot has that property. Right. So one of my colleagues challenged me to figure out a non-anthropomorphizing term for chatbot, because those are systems that exist. And we need a word for them. And I think a good word is conversation simulator, because that tells you what it's doing. But every time we talk about these things as thinking, as knowing, as answering, as struggling, as making mistakes, we are setting them up as something that isn't just a system that has a specific function, but maybe could be like us in some way, and maybe could be trusted to do things, and maybe we could displace accountability onto those systems. And so I think it's worthwhile to resist the anthropomorphizing language at every turn.
Or maybe like us and cannot be trusted and will take over the world.
So, yes, but that's also, you know, not a great way of thinking about it. And I think ultimately, even a person that you can't trust is a person who could be held accountable. And that's just not true of machines. And so we need to be sure to keep the people in the frame, the people who did all the data work behind it, and also the people who are making these deployment decisions, and not say AI is doing these harms, but rather companies, in the name of AI or companies trying to build AI are doing these harms.
So the way we think about it, the way we talk about it, is necessary for the solution to the problems AI raises. Is that really your argument?
And that is a part of it. I think it is valuable to recognize the language and to use different language. When I'm talking with someone and they say something full of anthropomorphizing language, I can call them on that and I think make what's at issue much, much clearer.
Will we ever have self-driving cars?
So that is, what do you mean by self-driving car, right? If you've got a system that's being monitored remotely and a person is stepping in 5% of the time to help it out of sticky situations, is that a self-driving car?
Not in my view, no. No, we're talking about a vehicle that goes along the road while everybody in the vehicle is reading their phones.
And nobody outside the vehicle is controlling it.
Nobody outside the vehicle. The vehicle itself is avoiding collisions, making moral choices about who to hit on the footpath, and taking you to the coffee shop without any intervention from the passengers or anybody outside the car. Self-driving.
So there are the Waymo taxis in California. I'm given to understand that Tesla has some sort of a pilot happening right now in Texas. I don't know to what extent those systems are completely free of external like pilots. I know that one of them, not going to remember which company it was found to have a whole workforce in Mexico monitoring the cars that were supposedly self-driving in the U.S. And I think for Waymo, I remember learning recently that they have a whole protocol for interacting with the police when a car gets stuck, because they do have some sort of remote supervision of the cars, but there's only so much you can do if you are not there in place. And so they're basically relying on the police to help them out.
An alternative would be to have a human being sitting behind a steering wheel.
Yeah, for example. And then it's like, okay, well, are we better off having that person not paying much attention, but trying to like snap into focus at a moment's notice when needed versus having that person actually be a driver? Just one other thing, if you want to solve issues around transportation, there's other things like trams and trains that go on dedicated tracks that can carry many more people at the same time.
So old-fashioned, Emily. You are so old-fashioned. You don't downplay the dangers of what we still have to call artificial intelligence. What do you see as the main danger of artificial intelligence being allowed to develop unchecked in the way that it has been over the last decade or so?
So I would put the people in the frame phrasing that. I don't think AI is autonomously developing unchecked. I think what we have are massive concentrations of data, of wealth, of computing resources. And I see a lot of harm just in that very concentration. And it is being unchecked, I think, by regulation. But the regulation isn't, oh, we have to regulate so-called artificial intelligence. It's more along the lines of, should we put limits on the extent to which data centers can use electrical and water resources? Should we put limits, and I think we very much should, on the extent to which data can be amassed, right? We need data minimization principles, which we really don't have in the US. Europe's doing a little bit better. I don't know the situation here in Australia. But these are the kinds of things where I think we really want to keep control over data and what's known about us individually at the individual and community level, and not just surrender to the idea that if a company can grab hold of it, then they have the right to have it.
And what gives you most hope?
What gives me the most hope? I think seeing people connecting with each other realizing that our own value and lived experience and expertise is highly relevant in these conversations. And every time I see someone say, yeah, actually, I do have something to say here, you don't have to be the expert in building the automation to have really valuable and, in fact, probably the most important opinions around when and how we should be automating something. It's the people who are using the automation, and especially the people who are having it used on them, that I think should have the most say there.
And don't ever believe the bullshit.
Exactly.
Emily, thank you for joining me on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delightful conversation.
I have been speaking to Emily Bender, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Washington, about her new book, The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. This is Late Night Live.